Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. The House moves closer to voting on a bill to overhaul the nation's healthcare system, but the chairman of a key Senate committee says it won't vote on a healthcare plan before the August recess begins next week. The House approves a $636 billion defense bill that contains funding for several military programs the Pentagon doesn't want. And President Obama and Vice President Biden share beers with the professor and the policeman at the center of a racial profiling controversy. Joining me in the studio to discuss these stories and more, Cheryl Gay-Stolberg of the New York Times, syndicated columnist Tony Blankley, and David Korn of Mother Jones Magazine. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, President Obama had demanded that Congress produce health care bills before they left on their August recess. Cheryl, it doesn't look like that's going to happen in either house.
That's right. And, you know, it's a problem for the president because now lawmakers will go home to their districts all across the country and face questions from constituents about what this health care bill will do. That's what people want to know. What's in it for me? Well, without these bills, we don't really have a clear answer of what's in it for me. And so the president and congressional Democrats are now left in the position of having to go out and try to sell this bill or this plan without really having specifics. And then, of course, Republican opponents will go out and will try to make the case, as they have been making, that it will drive up the deficit, that it will force you socialized medicine, people will lose their doctors, government-run plan, et cetera, et cetera. We'll see a big battle in August.
You know, David Korn, in the House, the issue is not Republicans. It's Democrats divided from other Democrats. Tell us what's happening in the House.
Well, there are two dynamics going on. Earlier this week, a deal was cut with the so-called Blue Dog Democrats, 51, 52 members who a lot come from rural areas considered to be conservative Democrats, that watered down a lot of the plan that had been worked on in the Energy and Commerce Committee, which is chaired by Henry Waxman, who is a pretty stalwart liberal member of the Democratic leadership. And that, you know, was touted as progress. But last night, 57 members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, the House liberals, sent a note to Waxman and Speaker Pelosi saying that they can't support this bill because they believe it does water down the public option and other provisions as well. So the hard thing is getting the Democrats all on one page, which sort of gets back to one of the fundamental issues here, is the calculation that the president made early on to do the opposite of what the Clintons did back in the 90s, which was to sort of step back, let Congress produce its own plan rather than put anything forward himself, and say, I'd like you guys to get behind this. So you have this problem on the House side. On the Senate side, you have some conservative Democrats bonding with some moderate Republicans to try to produce a plan of their own, while there are two committees run by Democrats who've put out, who are also working on this.
You know, Tony Blankley, the issue in the Senate Finance Committee is between Democrats and Republicans. Unlike in the House, we have been waiting for weeks and weeks thinking a bill's going to come out tomorrow, a bill's going to come out the next day from the Senate Finance Committee. Still no bill. How long will this process go on? I mean, is there a point where Democratic leaders will say, enough with the bipartisanship?
Well, it depends on how they see their votes otherwise. Right now, you've got Senators Enzi, Grassley, and Snow, the Republicans, who are negotiating with the Democratic Leadership Committee, Baucus, and that's going to go on through the August break. They are not ready to propose a bill yet. Obviously, I'm sure the Democratic leadership would like to have at least a half a dozen Republican senators vote on whatever final passage is so that they can claim that it's not just them, which is an interesting view of how they see the politics of this playing out afterwards, wanting to have Republican fingerprints on it. If you think you've got a really popular program, you probably would like to have it all for yourself as a party. I think the president's, along with what has been described about this problem in August, his biggest strategic problem is that all the efforts to realize his objectives regarding health health care, which is basically to cover virtually all Americans, to do it without increasing the deficit, and to bring down over time overall health care costs. CBO says can't be done with the proposals coming forward. So the president has to decide either to change his objective or to change the programs. And until he does, he's going to be caught where Bush was in 2005 when he pushed Social Security without enough specifics, and the Democrats were able to throw out at that time every possible scary point, and now the reverse is happening.
And of course, nothing happened with the president's Social Security proposal in those days. Well, Cheryl, what's the thinking at the White House? Do they think that the president needs to change his approach on this?
Well, it's been interesting to watch the president. You know, in previous bills, the stimulus bill and others, the president's approach has been to let Congress do its work, as David said, and to step in at the end and try to broker a deal once the two bills get to conference. Now, we're seeing him weigh in a little bit more in meetings with lawmakers. He weighed in on an issue of reforming an obscure group called the Medicare Advisory Commission. But I think they are still holding back, and he doesn't want to come in and sort of put his foot down and say, you guys must do this. They are still in a mode of letting the lawmakers work it out among themselves. And I think they are now kind of looking to September. I would not be surprised if we saw the president deliver a joint address to Congress in September when they come back. I should say no such address has been announced, but this is something that Bill Clinton did back in 1993. And I think the president would want to use his bully pulpit on health care reform this way. And we've seen him out stumping for the plan campaign style.
Well, there's been no shortage of hearing from President Obama.
Right.
Town hall meetings and interviews, and yet it doesn't, what we see happening in a series of national polls is that his approval rating when it comes to handling health care is going down, and now several of the polls, including the USA Today Gallup poll, show a net disapproval for him on handling health care.
Yeah, for some polls that's true. For some polls there's still a net approval for what's described as the plan, but he's really losing independence. I've seen some private polls that indicate, you know, Democrats are wildly behind him on most areas of health care reform in most areas, but independents are slipping away, and that is a problem. And I think, you know, riffing off what Cheryl and Tony have said, that, you know, he's out there doing a lot and he's a good campaigner, but he's still the question still is doing what for what. In that there is no bill. He's not saying, get behind this bill. And he's not engaging the public. The press conference he gave last week, I thought he showed a tremendous command of the policy dimensions of the fight. But he didn't say I want you to pick up the phone and call your members and get them behind this, that, or the other thing. Because there is no this, that yet. And I think that's, you know, that's part of the what might be a miscalculation. Yeah, I would never bet against these guys because, by and large, they've gotten most of what they've wanted from the day he entered the presidential race. And Rahm Emanuel is confidently telling people that they think they're 80% of the way there and they'll work it out through August and they'll come back with a package that everyone will get behind. And so he may be right. But right
now,
you
wouldn't expect Rahm Emanuel to say, oh, my goodness, we're in a terrible, desperate state.
But one thing we do know about the Obama White House is it tends not to get rattled. They tend to have a philosophy of saying, we want to keep our eye on the big picture. We don't want to be distracted by side issues. They, in a way, the White House itself reflects the personality of the president, which is sort of calm and steady. They've settled on this as their approach, and it does not seem that they're going to change it. One conundrum he faces, though, is that if he dips his hand into the legislative process and sticks his neck out and says, I support X, Y, and Z, this has to be in the bill, then if he doesn't get that in the end, it's a defeat for him, and that would be a problem.
Tony?
If the White House advisors are not rattled by the polling data, they ought to be. Gallup daily tracking poll, over the last 10 days, Obama's approval, not health care, his overall job approval has gone down from 61 to 52. The negatives have gone up from 32 to 40. It's a swing. He's losing a point a day. A point a day on his job approval, not health care, job approval. Those are bad numbers. They cannot continue. What's happening is that his advisors are sending him out every day to deliver a message that the public doesn't like, and so he's reinforcing the negativity of the message on him in person. He doesn't have the surrogates. He doesn't have the vice president or others doing this. He's delivering an unpopular message that hasn't been calibrated to be popular yet, so he's doing damage to himself.
But I don't think it's all that unpopular. There are a lot of different aspects to the message. You tell about the public. the public option. That rates really well. In the press conference, he talked about pre-existing conditions. You know, that goes through the roof when you ask people about, you know, their own health insurance needs. And but I do think Cheryl's right. I mean, you saw that in the campaign. It's how they run the White House. They get their – they have their sort of – practical application, whatever grand theory they have, and they stick with it, while we in the press corps often say, what about this, what about that? And they go, well, we'll see.
You know, usually if you had a GDP report come out, a report on the growth of the economy, and it showed a contraction for the fourth consecutive quarter, this would be seen as bad news. But report out this morning, GDP went down 1% in the second quarter of the year, and this is being hailed as really good news. Why is that, Tony?
Well, because they expected 1.5% contraction, so it's a little bit better, substantially better than they expected. Everybody's hoping that we're waiting to find the bottom of this economic contraction nationally, and the sooner we find the bottom, presumably the sooner we start going back up. So this is somewhat good news. I mean, the reality is that between the 6.4% contraction in the first quarter and the 1% in the second, we've lost about $1 trillion of wealth in this country in the first 6 months. It's $3,000 per person, $12,000 per family of four. So along with hoping we're bottoming out, the pain continues, and it continues to increase, although at a diminishing rate.
A jobless number is still not too encouraging, Cheryl.
That's absolutely right. Initial jobless claims for the week ended last week rose, I think, 25,000. But within that report was maybe a tiny bright spot. Continuing unemployment claims are going down. And also, we should take these numbers in a larger context. We got good news on housing this week, a report saying that the real estate prices are starting to turn around, or seem to be, for the first time in 3 years. The Cash for Clunkers program, people are rushing to buy new cars, so that's pretty good news.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg is White House correspondent for The New York Times. We're going to continue our conversation about the news of the week when we come back after a very short break. Our phone lines open, 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio for the first hour of our Friday News Roundup, David Korn. He's Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine, and his blog has just moved to politicsdaily.com. And Tony Blankley. He's a syndicated columnist and a research fellow with the Heritage Foundation. And Cheryl Gay Stolberg of The New York Times. Well, we sent out a tweet this morning from the DR show and ask what your number one domestic story is this week. Here's one answer we got back. Quote, if you ask the media, it's a couple guys having a beer. It has gotten the so-called beer summit led all three network newscasts last night. David, what was happening?
Well, I think people know by now. There were three guys and also a surprise guest appearance by Vice President Joe Biden joining the president and Sergeant James Crowley of the Cambridge Police Force and Henry Louis Gates Jr., professor of Harvard, for this long-awaited SUD summit. Ale to the Chief was my favorite pun headline of the week, in which they all got together, they talked, they seemed to get along. I don't think they got past one beer. I don't know if they got a second beer, but they did have nuts and pretzels as well. And they let the press film it for about 20 seconds, not within earshot, so you couldn't hear what was said. And I think by this point, it became pretty predictable. What this was all going to be about, and I hope it means that this is kind of over, and everybody can go back to worrying about healthcare or Paula Abdul?
Tony?
Well, I think this is sort of an odd combination of the typical summer silly season story, alcohol and race, which don't go together terribly well usually, and the reality, at a political reality, it's done two things. One, it has taken the focus off of the healthcare issue to some extent. Query whether that helps or hurts the president, given what the public thinks about that issue right now. And two, I would argue that since the polls show that only about 30% of the public thinks that the president handled this race issue well at his press conference, it's reinforcing a message that 70% of the public didn't think the president performed well on. So I wonder whether it's really useful to have this much coverage on something which is sort of a gaffe on the part of the president.
Well, Cheryl, why did the White House feel like they wanted to have this meeting?
Well, I think the president has been all about trying to transcend race, right? He hasn't dwelled very much on race. This comment that he made at the press conference when he said the Cambridge police acted stupidly in arresting Professor Gates generated widespread attention, clearly made the situation worse. The president knew that. He knew that by interjecting himself, he had worsened things. And so I think maybe it came into the category of it seemed like a good idea at the time. I do think, despite the frivolous press coverage and the insane attention to who drank what kind of beer, I love that Sergeant Crowley drank Blue Moon, and I don't believe the president really drinks Budweiser all the time.
Bud Light.
Bud Light. I do think it has actually been a teachable moment for the nation, not the beer summit per se, but the larger conversation around race, around how black men in particular are treated by the police. I do see actually a cultural and societal value in our having had this conversation.
But the White House keeps saying it's a teachable moment. And in the press room at the White House last week, they were pressed repeatedly, Robert Gibbs was, well, what's being taught? Is this about race? Is this about class? Is it town versus gown? Is it about community relations for the police? And who's doing the teaching? And who's getting the lesson? And beyond sort of, they couldn't really answer any of those questions because I think the episode still is a Rorschach test and there's no clarity to it. But I do think to the extent that the president came out last Friday in the press room and basically said, I made a mistake and I want to fix it. And the way I see fixing it is by bringing people together, just talking, because obviously these guys are angry at each other. And it's not the same thing as Sadat and Menachem Begin. But listen, we can try to bring together. To me, that was about as much of a teachable moment as you needed. And they should have just sort of done this quickly.
I think this was all about damage control. I mean, I don't know how carefully he had planned what he said at the news conference Wednesday. But I think the White House has been surprised by the reaction. In the Pew poll that found that Obama's approval rating fell 7 percentage points among white voters after the news conference, which could be as big a reason as health care for the fact that we've seen a decline in his approval rating.
That could well be the case. Look, he didn't say he made a mistake. He said he could have calibrated his words better. But any way you talk about it, I don't think this is a good story for the president.
He did say I ratcheted up this
he did
too.
Say
He took responsibility for making the situation worse.
Let me just suggest that I don't know the TikTok on the summit but my hunch is it came out that it had been suggested by the sergeant maybe they should get together for the beer and then the White House said we might do that and then everything fell into place. I'd be surprised if the top communications people at the White House really wanted what they got yesterday.
And in a way, you know, really, what choice did the president have? He's on the phone with this sergeant basically trying to say to him, hey, I'm sorry I maligned you in front of, you know, a nationally televised audience. And the guy says, well, yeah, it'd be great to come and have a beer at the White House. What's the president going to say? No, you can't come?
So why the surprise guest was Joe Biden, the vice
because
president?
Because he's fun and he's easy to talk to and he's a regular guy from Scranton.
And it makes it two whites and two blacks.
Exactly.
I'm not sure they were so crass in that calculation, but I think he just was walking by and said, hey, guys, what are you doing?
Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano, announced a new anti-terrorism strategy this week. How different is this plan from the strategy against domestic terrorism that the Bush administration followed?
Well, I find this funny because, of course, in January of 2002, then President Bush came out with a program that subsequently became known as TIPS, Operation TIPS, which is, it sounds like the same thing. He wanted to enlist the public to have their eyes open and make sure, see if they see dangerous things going on. He was viciously attacked both by Dick Armey, the Republican libertarian on the right, and by Senator Leahy on the left, and the ACLU saying this was domestic spying. They said that we would now have more domestic spies than the Stasi, and the program was finally killed by Congress later in that year. Now, by the way, I thought it was a little much for the secretary when she made her announcement to assert that in the past the government had only seen the public as a liability. Now we were going to use them as an asset, when in fact it was the President Bush who saw it as a potential, and everybody jumped down his throat, so he gave up. So I guess she's having another attempt to resuscitate a Bush initiative.
Cheryl, what did you make of these proposals?
I guess I think this comes under the category of sounds different is the same. You know, I think it was a change in tone from the Obama White House. But really, I mean, the president is charged with protecting Americans against terrorist attacks, and a Republican president or Democrat, I think we've seen from this administration that they're going to do this, and they're concerned with the war on terror. And in fact, Secretary Napolitano was criticized earlier this year for giving remarks to the Congress in which she failed to use the word terrorism. I noticed that in this speech, she talked frequently about terrorism, saying she wanted to enlist the public in a collective fight against terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. So, I don't see this as a big change from Bush policy, really.
You know, there is one thing that may change, and that is that Department of Homeland Security officials say we may stop this program of color alerts.
Right.
What would that matter, David? Have they worked?
You don't
or not
check
worked?
The color alert each morning you wake up. I mean, give me the example of anybody out there who has changed their behavior based on a color alert. Maybe, you know, it works for security at airports, but otherwise, I think it's pretty pointless. And I think it has probably been used to political end during the Bush years, less so.
To political end, how do you mean?
Well, near election time, when you want people to think about terrorism, because George Bush is going to protect you and the Democrats are going to sell you out to Al-Qaeda and your mother as well, then you heighten alert and get people thinking about it more. It was a very easy way to make the issue terrorism. But what the secretary did this week as well was to not go and say we need to revive TIPS. She talked about really focusing on the critical infrastructure of our program, of our country. And I do know that the nuclear industry still, you know, all these years after 9/11, has not yet put together a coordinated plan for securing nuclear power plants and facilities. So that's, you know, seems to me to be almost criminally negligent. And that if she's pushing that more, hey, that's fine. That's a good idea.
Tony?
Well, the color-coded thing, which had been giggled about for almost a decade now, nonetheless, what happens, I think, at a useful level is local law enforcement agencies are advised when the federal government thinks there's an increased risk in their area. That has an immediate consequence because law enforcement's personnel budget goes up because they go up to a higher level of attention. So you can't go up too often without running the budget down for local law enforcement agencies. But the mechanism by which the best intelligence in America is conveyed to state and local jurisdictions when they think there's an increased threat is an important piece of it. What the public thinks, given we've only got four or five levels, we don't really know what it means. I think it's pretty difficult for the public to take advantage of that.
Let's go to the phones and take a call. We'll talk to Keith. He's calling us from Jacksonville, Florida. Keith, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I've got a question about the Cash for Clunkers program that seems to have been very successful in the short period of time that it's been out there. And now they're talking about delaying it, or, you know, I'm hearing conflicting reports about it's supposed to go to November 1st, and now they're talking about, because of how much money's going out, that they'll cancel it early. And my question is, with the huge success, could that have been a better strategy to help the car companies by doing this instead of giving them the money directly? And then, you know, the consumers would have benefited?
Yeah, Keith, a good question. Cheryl, what do you think?
Well, first, to your question of extending it, the Michigan delegation, obviously tied closely to the auto industry, is going to be talking with the White House and trying to persuade the White House to extend this program. And we're hearing from the White House that they will work with Congress to try to extend it. Now, whether it will go till November 1st, I don't know. I don't know what kind of money can be set aside for it. As to whether or not this would have been a better way to help the car companies, I tend to think that the car companies were in pretty deep trouble, and that simply you couldn't spur enough people to buy new cars to dig them out of the hole that they were in.
Although it did show this apparently enormous pinup demand.
Yes, I thought that was excellent news, actually.
I mean, we don't know. Keep in mind, if you're told you can get $4,500 a car, some people are buying cars. About 9 million cars will have been sold even during the recession. If you're one of those 9 million and you're told you can get $4,500 extra, you're going to ask for it. How many people did that who weren't always already going to be buying a car? Mm-hmm. But I agree with the caller that if the government had wanted to help Detroit back in the stimulus package, if that government had decided to be the buyer of last resort, spent 50 or 100 billion of the 700 billion buying cars from Ford, Chevy, and GM and Chrysler, they could have kept the assembly lines running. They chose not to, but they could have actually kept the assembly lines running just buying the fleets of cars.
But I wonder, with this relatively good GDP number this morning, and a sense that the recession is bottoming out and will grow in the third quarter or certainly the fourth quarter, can the administration argue that the approach it took on the stimulus bill has turned out to work?
Well, I think they can argue that things are heading in a better direction now, if only in a worse, in a less worse direction. And, you know, Obama said in his first presidential press conference, what is your measure for the success of the stimulus bill? He said, check back in a year. And then you'll see what the job picture is and what the GDP picture is. And I think that's, you know, unfortunately, we do have to wait to get an idea.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850 and your emails at drshow@wamu.org. You can find us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Cheryl.
Well, as far as whether the president can claim the stimulus bill has worked, he still is confronting these high unemployment numbers. I don't think that at 10% unemployment, you can really say, yes, we've had a rousing success. And in fact, you heard the president this week at a town hall meeting referencing a magazine cover that declared the end of the recession. And he said, well, that's news to me. And it's probably news to you, too. So I think he's got a mixed picture here, which is better than the bad picture he had about a month ago.
Well, you know, one of the big problems on the economy has been all the mortgages and all these foreclosures, which have really continued. Now the administration is asking mortgage companies to modify 500,000 loans. What is it that they want to do?
Well, they want the people who mortgage service companies, which includes Bank of America, a lot of the big companies, to take people's loans that are on the brink of foreclosure and basically reduce their monthly payments so that they don't lose their houses. And they want 500,000 of those modifications performed, I think, by November of this year. Part of the problem is it's a lot of paperwork. There's only so much. So there's a lot of backlog already at these shop offices, private sector offices, trying to do it. The other danger, of course, is that each one that is modified reduces the revenues to the bank and risks puts the banks in relatively worse financial state, and our banks are still in a pretty precarious condition. So asking them to basically write down an asset, which is a part of a loan, it may have a contradictory process. But even if the banks wanted to cooperate, they'd have to hire a lot of people to move the paperwork faster. And I don't think this is going to be a major factor in foreclosure.
But aren't they better off getting less than they were getting on a mortgage than having somebody not be able to pay anything at all and they take over a house that's foreclosed?
I mean, every bank has its theory and formula of what's more profitable for them. At some point, they need to foreclose. At other points, they keep them along. I don't know the intricacies of how they judge what's more profitable for them. I assume they know it better than a congressman, mm-hmm. though.
One thing that we do know, though, is the banks also collect fees. Mortgage companies collect lucrative fees on delinquent loans. And obviously, if you're hurrying up the renegotiations, those fees are going to go down. That could play a factor as well.
And I think on the show yesterday morning, you had a bunch of economists who talked about this. And Dean Baker, you know, raised the issue of the right to rent proposal, which is if you are foreclosed, you still have the right then to stay in your house and continue to rent it. So that way you don't create, you know, blight within communities, and there's still some stabilization in areas where there are tremendous rates of foreclosure. That seems to me that's something that the administration should be pushing as well. I mean, their goal is to try to help 3 to 4 million Americans with modifications, which is really hard. And there are some people out who obviously that will work for, and there's still the problem that there's some people who bought homes largely because of the aggressive practices of lenders who won't be able to afford them even with modifications.
Tony, you're scowling.
Well, yeah, I mean, the right to rent. Let's say that I have a house and I'm foreclosed on. If I have a right to rent it, then the bank that is foreclosed on it can't sell the property without the encumbrance of my being in there. And therefore, the banks are going to hold on to these valueless assets for years with the property hanging over the marketplace. You've got to be able to, at some point, liquidate so that you can start over. That's the whole process. That's why we have bankruptcy laws. That's why we have foreclosure processes, so that somebody who capable of efficiently using the resource, in this case a house, can come into possession. Would be to undermine the bank's ability to transition the property to someone who can afford it.
You're right, Tony. The banks have shown that they are just great judges of market flows.
They're better than politicians.
They've done a great job in the last 10 years determining how our housing market works and policies go. So I think there are other values at stake here other than what the banks think best.
We're going to take another very short break. And when we come back, we'll talk about what's happening with the Supreme Court nomination of Sonia Sotomayor. We'll take your calls and read some of your emails. Stay with us. The Friday News Roundup. Defense Secretary Gates says...
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup. Defense Secretary Gates says the United States may be able to withdraw some American troops from Iraq sooner than planned. Iranian police break up demonstrations at the grave of a woman killed in post-election protests. And Chinese and administration officials meet in Washington. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. With me in the studio for our Friday News Roundup, Tony Blankley, David Korn, and Cheryl Gay Stolberg. You know, we were talking about the beer summit before the break. Here's an email from Tom Schlafly, who is president, he says, of the St. Louis Brewery. And he says, as the president of what is now the largest American-owned brewery in St. Louis, I was extremely disappointed that the only products served at the so-called beer summit were brewed by foreign companies. Billions of tax dollars were spent to bail out American automobile companies. What about American breweries, which now account for only 5% of the U.S. market? We're not asking for federal aid, he said, but if our taxes are going to pay for a photo opportunity at the White House, surely at least one beer from an American-owned brewery would be worth showcasing.
Well, Skip Gates made a late-minute change from Red Stripe, a Jamaican beer, to Sam Adams, which is indeed one of the larger from one of the larger breweries in America. So maybe he was feeling the pain of some of the American breweries. And most people do believe that Budweiser, the king of beers, is actually an American company, but was recently bought out by the Belgians.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, when I was on the Reagan White House staff, I know that they never served foreign wine, even at state dinners. It was always California or something. So, in fact, White Houses do have to be careful because it stands for the country, and they should have American-made products. Because this event happened so quickly, it probably wasn't advanced in down to that detail of product placement.
Although you'd think they'd choose the president, since the president...
I think they all got to...
I just don't think the White House is this Machiavellian to be thinking, playing out the beer selections. Oh. But maybe they should have been.
Oh yeah, I mean, my guess would be that the president or his person just assumed that Bud was an American beer. I had to be reminded that it was now owned by a Belgian company.
Here's an email from Nancy. She writes us from New Hampshire. She says, "Can your panel explain why on Earth we need so many polls? Who gets polled? I never do, nor does anyone I know." You know, it is true that we talk about polls almost every week on the News Roundup.
Well, you know, institutions like USA Today and Gallup keep putting them out. And, polls, I think, tend to be, you know, kind of accurate. That's the problem here. Sometimes they fly off and go off in the wrong direction. But, you know, we live in a very big country. And it's hard to get a grip on what is really happening outside the Beltway or any place else. I think, you know, and if you live in a small European country like Holland, you can talk to 50, 100 people and get a general sense of what's happening. It's much more homogeneous than our society is. Polls give us some indication of how things are playing. And as Cheryl, I think, mentioned earlier, this White House seems to be, I'm sure they do polling and all that stuff, but they don't seem to be, for good or bad, they don't seem to change their policies or directions too much.
Well, they do polling, first of all. But second of all, we have a lot of polls. Maybe we don't need a lot of polls, but we have them because we have a lot of news organizations. And it's the news organizations that do the polls. And as a member of a news organization, I, for one, am in favor of the country having a lot of news organizations.
Yeah, look, there's a constant demand for polls. And if a news organization publishes one, it may get reported in another news organization begrudgingly. But as far as the White House not paying attention to its polling, I would point out that starting a few days ago, the White House and now the Democrats on the Hill are now talking about insurance reform rather than health care reform. And yesterday we saw everybody beating up on the Democratic side, beating up on the insurance industry. And I believe they may even report that they found that insurance was a nice,
you
juicy
know,
target.
I don't think you need a poll to say that insurance companies
well,
are unpopular.
But they did have a poll.
I believe you're right. And in fact, yesterday we heard Speaker Nancy Pelosi call insurance companies villains, which I thought was a remarkable choice.
I think that has been the most interesting change in rhetoric this week, and we've seen it not only out of the House Speaker, but also out of the President himself at town hall meetings, saying we're not going to let these insurance companies take advantage of you. We're really seeing a sort of a beating up on the insurers, who are maybe the last group at the table who have not come out and said, yes, we can get behind this plan.
Well, they've been fighting the public option, which is a key component. And I think when Americans think about health care, they like their doctors, they like their providers. A lot of people actually are satisfied with the type of care they get. But what they worry about and what they fear are the interventions of the insurance companies. And a lot of people have had very, very negative experiences. I have had in my own family, and most of my friends have. And so that seems to be, to a lot of people who have insurance, the thing that needs change the most. So when the president says, what's in it for you? Well, I think others want to hear better relationship with insurance companies.
We have an email from Carrie who says, please explain the key differences between the public option, which David just mentioned, and co-ops, which is what it looks like the Senate Finance Committee may do instead.
Let me start by confessing I do not understand exactly what the co-op is. As I understand a co-op in general, it's a group of producers who get together to commonly sell their products. So you have milk co-ops, which is sort of a form of legal price control, usually to keep the price up, is what co-ops usually do for farmers. How this applies to getting Blue Cross and Aetna into a co-op together to protect themselves, puny as they are, into something more grand. I don't understand. And my sense is that this has been an attempt to find some kind of a phrase that can hold some plausible claim to a public insurance, which is what the left wants from Obama, and some plausible gratification for conservatives who are afraid of that. And we'll have to, until we see the legislative language, nobody's going to know what that word means.
Yeah, I confess, as same with Tony, that I don't understand the intricacies of how it will work. But this idea flows out of Senator Kent Conrad, who comes from North Dakota, a farm state. And he has told me in interviews that it is modeled on some of these farm cooperatives, electricity cooperatives, and other cooperatives that are very commonplace in his home state. And it would involve private insurers, I suppose, or private companies getting together in a cooperative arrangement so that it wouldn't simply be the government offering one big plan, but various small entities getting together to form this cooperative. How it precisely will work, I confess, I don't know.
I'm from Kansas. I was born and raised there, and which is a place with a lot of suspicion toward the idea of government-run health care, and yet it is also a place where grain co-ops and electricity co-ops have played a big role in development, especially in some of the rural areas of the state. Well, let's go to Michelle. She's calling us from Dallas, Texas. Michelle, thanks for holding on.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a big question about health care that I've not heard anybody address, and that is, if there's 50 million newly insured people, who is going to treat them? Are we all of a sudden going to have a bunch of new doctors and a bunch of new nurses? That's my first question. My second part of the question is, and I really want that addressed, though. But the second part, again, is with all the new people insured, I still am surprised that we're not talking about the lawsuits. To me, I hear that we're going to give doctors pay cuts, and no, I'm not a doctor, and I'm not related to one. But we're talking about giving them pay cuts, and all of a sudden they're going to have 50 million new patients. They still have to worry about if they miss one test, they could get sued if they miss one diagnosis. And that seems like, you know, that we're asking them to take this huge responsibility while asking them to take pay cuts, asking them to take new patients, millions of them. And it just seems crazy. And like I said, I don't even have a strong opinion on whether we should or should not do this. But it just seems like, how are we going to implement this? How are we going to get seen?
All right, Michelle, thanks so much for your call. Cheryl, is there concern about having enough primary care doctors to handle this new influx of patients that we have universal coverage?
Well, first of all, I think we need to realize we already have these patients. These people are Americans. They get sick already. They get treated and cared for in very inefficient ways often by going to the emergency room, let's say. So some of this will just simply be, I assume, greater efficiencies. There is clearly a nursing shortage, and we've known that for a long time. But it would seem to me that some of these folks are already getting treated, and we're all absorbing the cost.
I don't think there's there is still a nursing shortage, although I think that's a pipeline shortage now because the salaries for nurses have gone up. But I have read concern about the supply of doctors to handle people who could now get primary care as opposed to emergency care.
We know because CBO scored it at about $1 trillion of increased cost to cover the percentage. It's not even all of the 47 million that would be covered. Yes, it's true that people who don't have coverage go to emergency centers for emergency treatment, but they don't go to their doctors regularly. They don't have all the precautionary tests that we have. They don't have the annual physicals. All the things that raise the cost of health care would be new, and that's why the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, has said this is going to cost $1 trillion at least over 10 years.
But one thing that Obama has tried to put the spotlight on as we debate health care reform are different delivery systems, such as the Cleveland Clinic, Mayo Clinic, and places where there are doctors who get salaries. It's not fee for each service or test they provide, and these are as Cheryl mentioned, some of the ways of introducing greater efficiencies. So if you have a greater pool of people to treat, you can go that way. The hard thing is taking those models, which do work, and making them more institutionally established throughout the entire healthcare system.
It is certainly true that one of the things that makes healthcare so hard to reform or to overhaul is that every step has consequences on some other step that you have to deal with. Now, this week we saw Sonia Sotomayor get one step closer to becoming a Supreme Court justice. A vote in the Senate Judiciary Committee approved her nomination, sends it to the floor next week. Almost a party line vote, Tony, not quite.
Yeah, well, Senator Lindsey Graham voted with, and it's obviously going to go to the floor, and she's going to pass. It'll be interesting to see whether, you know, how many negative Republican votes are compared with how many negative Democratic votes there were for Justice Roberts. President Obama, when he was senator, voted against Roberts. So this has become the pattern that when you have a conservative nominee, Democrats tend to vote against that person. When you have a liberal nominee, Republicans tend. This is a shift from the 80s when Scalia, for instance, very conservative, nominated by Reagan, got passage 98-0. But after that, the tradition in Washington has changed. So we should expect for the foreseeable future to see these split liberal-conservative kind of votes.
You know, I was interested this week to see the announcement by the Texas Senator K. Bailey Hutchison, who is going to be resigning from the Senate this fall to run for governor of Texas. She was in, I think, politically kind of a tough position. Tell us about it, Cheryl.
Well, she's going to be running for governor of Texas in a state that is a conservative state, but also a state with a large Hispanic population. As we know, Judge Sonia Sotomayor is set, if she is confirmed, to become the first Latina Supreme Court justice. So the senator had a decision to make. She says, I believe, that she will vote against, which tells me that she's more concerned about her opposition in the primary from Republican Governor Rick Perry, primary of obviously Republican voters, conservatives, than she is concerned about the general election, when she'll have to worry that perhaps voting against a Hispanic woman will come back to haunt her.
If you get into the politics of this, it's a little trickier, because she is a Puerto Rican, and most of the Hispanics who live in Texas are Mexicans, and the phrase Hispanic was created by the Nixon administration. And in fact, when you look at polling, you find out that Hondurans and Guatemalans have different views on issues when they come to America. So if you're doing a political operation, you have to be very focused on which Hispanics you're interacting with as a politician, and where is their disposition, and it's not always predictable.
So are you saying that it's okay for her, or she doesn't have to worry politically because Judge Sotomayor is Puerto Rican and her constituency is of Mexican descent?
I'm simply saying that if you're suggesting that she's making a political calculation, and every politician does, that a good politician will also assess within the category of Hispanic down to more tighter demographics to figure out what the real effects are likely to be.
I'm Susan Page. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show.
Which is not, though, what you seem to see during the confirmation hearings, when I think, you know, the Republican Party has this issue. Lindsey Graham made it very explicit. He said, we got to show the rest of the world that we're not just a party of short white guys. I guess that means get some taller white guys. But it was, you know, their condescension towards her, I think, was quite remarkable. You know, they treated her in a way clearly they would not have treated a man, and maybe that was because she was a Hispanic woman as well. When Tom Coburn said to her, "You have lots of splaining to do," I mean, that was just remarkable that someone thinks they could get away with this. Now, at the end of the day, I think there's nothing wrong with senators voting against a nominee on ideology. You don't want a conservative court, then Democrats should vote against Alito and Roberts. You don't want a liberal court, then vote against Sotomayor or whoever else Obama puts forward. And I think people can live with that. It is a change, as Tony notes, historically. But the biggest problem they had is just the Republican Party was their general approach to this nomination.
Seen as a big victory for the administration last week when the Senate voted to end the F-22 fighter jet program, which the administration opposed. And this week, the House also decided not to include additional funding for the F-22. And yet the House defense spending bill this week still gives the Pentagon dozens of ships and planes and helicopters and armored vehicles that the Defense Secretary Bob Gates says the Pentagon does not want. Why are they?
Yeah, well, look, there's a very tricky game going on here. First of all, Pentagons invariably don't ask for things they really want, knowing that there are key congressmen, subcommittee chairmen on Appropriations Committee, for example, on defense appropriations, who will put it back in because it's produced partially in their district. So the game of requesting is very subtle. On top of that, the Congress wants stuff for their home districts, and that's why the defense contractors, they put these packages together where they're produced in a lot of important congressional districts. I don't think Obama, with all the fights he's got on the Hill, needs to have a procurement fight with his Democratic allies in the House and Senate.
It does show, though, how this system is just completely nuts. absolutely nuts that you can have John Murtha or anybody. It's not a partisan thing, you know, spending millions and billions of taxpayer dollars of the $6.9 billion they sort of put back into the bill. I think $2.7 billion are earmarks. And, you know, this is where John McCain is right and others are right. And unfortunately, it's a system by which, you know, more people benefit than not in terms of the people who run this system, the members of Congress. So it's almost invulnerable to reform.
Well, you know, this is going to be a test for the president. I mean, the White House is threatening to veto this bill. It includes a new presidential helicopter that the president himself says he doesn't want. John McCain kind of put him on the spot early on and announced at a public meeting at the White House, Mr. President, what are you going to do about this helicopter? And the president said, well, gee, I think my current helicopter I have is just fine. I don't need a new one. The Congress is trying to push it on him. Now, if it's included in the bill, he says, or his White House says, he'll veto it. And we haven't seen the president veto a bill yet.
And especially veto a defense spending bill.
Yeah.
That helicopter is $6 billion over budget. You have to probably try to get something that much over budget.
Well, I want to thank all three of you for joining us on the News Roundup. We've had David Korn from Mother Jones Magazine, Tony Blankley, a syndicated columnist, and Cheryl Gay Stolberg from The New York Times. Thanks for being with us on The Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back on Monday. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.